Hi, everybody. I'm Lisa Tworsky, and with me now is Dr. Alyssa Kushner. Dr. Kushner is a clinical psychologist in private practice and at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. She got her PsyD at LaSalle University and did her postdoctorate training in anxiety disorders at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Kushner.
Thank you
for being here. I'm really excited about this workshop. This workshop is Understanding Scrupulosity, which we'll get to why in a moment, but which I think is really such an important piece of training and understanding and learning specifically for this population that this series is for, residents and college teachers. Let's start with just defining what is scrupulosity.
Sure. So scrupulosity is really what we think of as religious OCD. Mm-hmm. So OCD is an anxiety disorder that is based on obsessions and compulsions. So obsessions are any kind of intrusive thought, image, or impulse that somebody has that causes them distress. And then the compulsions are any kind of thing that the person does either mentally or physically to try to relieve that anxiety and to make themselves feel better in some way. And so when someone has those types of intrusive thoughts that are related to either a really intense sense of morality or something that's related to religion, we consider it scrupulosity.
And could we just to sort of bring it to life, what does that look like? What are some typical scenarios of scrupulosity, religious OCD for women in our community?
So within our community, scrupulosity can present itself in lots of different ways. Some of the most common ones are women who are dealing with issues that are related to kashrus or to taras mishpacha are probably the biggest issues. So for example, women who are really concerned about basar kalav and feeling like they're constantly gonna make a mistake in their kitchen and trafe it up and then spread that, you know, trafeness to their family or to the world. Or women who are concerned when they're preparing for the mikvah or when they're using the mikvah that maybe they didn't do it correctly. But we could also see it in terms of the way that women approach their davening, that they're very careful about it and very worried about getting it right and having the right kavana or and kibud av ha'im is also a pretty common area for women.
And we'll get to men in a second. Maybe some of it's the same, maybe some of it's very different. But just to sort of, you know, really hone in on what part's the obsession and what part in that equation is the compulsion, what are we talking about? You know, when we say they might have it around kashrus and being worried that they're gonna, you know, trafe somebody up, where's the obsession? Where's the compulsion? What's sort of their process that's going on? Just for our own, you know, education and understanding.
So the obsession is usually the thought that goes along with it. So it's the concern that somebody has when they, for example, you know, they're going to give their kids cereal in the morning with milk, and then they worry that perhaps their hands still have fleshigs on them from the night before. Mm-hmm. And maybe now that they're gonna be touching the milk container and the milk container is now gonna have fleshigs on it and somebody else isn't gonna know. And then, you know, they're going to, that something bad is gonna happen. So now, so the obsession was the thought that maybe I am now getting fleshigs on this milk. Mm-hmm. And then the compulsion is what they're gonna do about it. So maybe now they're gonna go and scrub their hands or they're going to tell their husband, oh, by the way, the milk is now fleshigs, you know, so we have to throw it out. Or they do throw it out because now they're worried about it.
Uh-huh. So the obsession is the thought and the compulsion is usually the action, although it can also be sort of a thinking process or an internal process.
It can. So it can be an internal process. So for example, they might be keeping a list in their head of all of the things that they've touched with their fleshig hands so that they can go back and clean them later. So they might have kind of that running list, or they might be trying to figure it out in their head. If I touched this, then, you know, what could that mean? And trying to think it through, either to tell themselves it's not a problem or to...
So we understand now the sort of the process and some of the areas where women are struggling or where women will have this OCD, religious OCD. But I think it's also important to know what are the common areas for men in our community, because sometimes a college teacher or a Rebbetzin will be approached by a woman who has concerns, issues, complaints about her husband, and also needs to understand what might it look like if somebody's husband is suffering from scrupulosity.
So some of the common areas for men in the FRM community can be similar to the issues that women have, so they could really have any of those things. But they also, some of the more common areas are having scrupulosity related to their davening, having scrupulosity related to their learning, being very concerned that maybe they didn't understand the shir, they're not clear about the Gemara, that they're, you know, they're very worried about whether they understood it correctly or whether they were paying attention correctly. Some of the other things that are common are making sure that they're really clean before davening. So it could be that a woman is saying, you know, my husband is spending 3 hours in the morning in the bathroom to try to make sure that they're really clean, you know, before he goes davening. He's missing davening every morning. So, you know, what do I do about that? So that's a very common one as well.
And I guess that kind of brings you the question. We just, as this is being interview is being done, we just finished, we just had Purim. And I guess, you know, it's a great example. Everyone wants to know and make sure that they heard the whole Megillah.
Yeah.
Right? So there's sort of that normative, we're all supposed to be concerned. What is the difference, or how does it sound different when somebody is approaching it from an OCD place rather than just a place of sort of regular piousness? How do we understand? Maybe it's a good way to give us an example of helping us differentiate.
So, I mean, that is a great example. So for me, I did hear the Megillah twice at night. And so, but that's because I know that I left the middle of the Megillah to take my baby, you know, to change her diaper, right? So I know for sure that I did not hear the entire Megillah. And it was very simple to say, okay, I need to go and hear it again. However, when we're dealing with somebody with scrupulosity, it typically goes way beyond that. So typically it would be somebody who sat there from the beginning of the Megillah to the end of the Megillah. They know that they were in the room, but they maybe were worried that their mind wandered and so they missed something. Or they were worried that, you know, maybe somebody coughed while that was sitting next to them. And so therefore, maybe they didn't get to hear a word or a piece of a word even, right? So typically it's things that are sort of way above and beyond the way that most people would think about these things. For Rebbetzins, for college teachers, it's when you start to hear a lot of questions that involve things like maybe or a long-winded explanation. So if somebody had gone to the Rav about the Megillah and said, so there was somebody that was sitting three rows in front of me, and I think that they coughed in the middle of Perek Zion. I'm not really sure, but I think that they did. And so maybe there was a word that I didn't hear. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, a Rav by that point is going to be thinking like, what? Right? That doesn't even make any sense. So usually that's a good clue for us that something kind of goes way beyond what other people would think about or would worry about. It often, you know, is when people kind of miss the forest for the trees. So it's like the example that I was giving you before, where somebody might spend 3 hours in the bathroom making sure that they're fully clean, but then winds up missing davening, or the man is so busy worrying about the placement of tefillin that he can't get, you know, that he can't start his davening.
Right.
But those are usually clues that things are wrong.
So it's missing the forest for the trees, like you said. It's a lot, if the person is approaching somebody to talk about it, it's a lot of explanations and maybe this, and sounding almost happy in it, but tortured in there, you know, and maybe, and I think this, and then that, and so maybe, and it sounds very heavy and distressed.
Absolutely. So I think that when we think about this, you know, when people take on extra mitzvahs or you know, are deciding that they want to be more careful in a certain mitzvah, it's not painful for them. right? Maybe if they say, oh, I'm going to wear, you know, longer sleeves and it's 90 degrees out, maybe it's a little physically uncomfortable sometimes, right? But it's really not a painful thing to take on a mitzvah that people are excited about. Mm-hmm. And when you are dealing with somebody with OCD, it is. I mean, the whole experience is really painful for them. Going to the mikvah can be extremely painful because it's so time consuming, so disruptive to them and their household and their shalom bayis, to the point where, like, you know, going to the mikvah really loses all of the positive things that are supposed to come from it.
Right. And how is it the same or different than regular, or whatever you would call, other OCD? Is it just that we've given it a special designation because of the subject matter, or are there other differences from OCD?
So I would say on a broad level, it's really the same, right? So in terms of the same process that the person goes through with the obsessions and compulsions, that part is definitely the same. In terms of it having a separate name, there are other types of OCD that also have sort of a special designation and are considered subtypes of OCD. But in terms of the treatment, that part's really the same. The harder part with scrupulosity is sort of exactly the question that you were asking before. So actually, people with scrupulosity don't do quite as well with the same kind of treatments. And one of the reasons that we think that is because they tend to have a little bit less insight into their problem. So they tend to look at it and think, you know, and sometimes their family and the community also doesn't have as much insight. We all may look at it and say, wow, you know, that person spends 3 hours davening in the morning.
So committed.
Like, we're tzaddik, right? We start, like, when our kids are little, you know, and say, like, oh, you're such a tzaddikus, look at you, you know, and we have to really think about what that means, that our kid is taking twice as long as their friends to do benching. Like, what is this a problem or not? And we really have to pay attention to those. When people get praised for things like that, it tends to kind of, I'm not going to say that it reinforces the behavior, although it may, but I think it's even more than that, that they tend to just think, well, this is not a problem, clearly, or somebody would be saying, you know, I think this is a problem, instead of saying, oh, good for you.
Right. So somebody who has other kinds of OCD, although they may also not be going for help, internally, they have more insight into the fact that this is problematic.
Yeah.
I might not reach out for whatever other reasons, whether it's shame, whether it's fear, whether it's stigma, whatever it is, but they kind of know I shouldn't be, you know, having to wash my hands 4 times, step over the threshold 3 times, and then, you know, check the door four times before I leave. They know.
Exactly. Yeah. They might say to themselves, you know, they're well aware. They might be doing it because it still makes them feel better and it still makes them feel safer. Like, it's sort of the just in case, you know, that somebody's worried about. So, you know, if I don't step over the threshold, I'm not going to get all those things right that you said, but they're all good examples. You know, if I don't do those things right, then maybe it makes me feel like something bad is going to happen to me, but it probably isn't. Whereas with some of these issues related to scrupulosity, people say, like, well, I could be chayav kares. I could be, you know, I mean, they just think, like, the repercussions are so catastrophic in their mind that it's, you know, it's not worth it to what they think of as pushing the envelope.
Right. And is it intense about how we teach our religion that we induce this, or, you know, I think people kind of want to know why is this happening? Is it only our religion? And is it, you know, is it religion? What's going on with that? I think we need to clarify.
So I guess the good news is it's not just us. So, I mean, every kind of organized religion that has a lot of rules is kind of subject to this being an issue. That being said, I mean, I think that it does give us the opportunity to be somewhat mindful of the way that we teach things, right? So I think that when we have someone who we're seeing has is demonstrating some of these characteristics, or we're concerned that they have scrupulosity, I think that we have to be, I think it lends it the opportunity to be more careful in the way that we answer them and in the way that we talk to them about it. So, you know, with somebody else, as a college teacher, you may want to say, you know, we do X, Y, and Z. We don't do X, Y, you know, X, Y, and Z. And it's fine to say it that way. With somebody that we're sensing might have a problem, you know, it can be a little bit better sometimes to like talk in broader brushstrokes, not to get stuck in so many of the details that the person is going to then twist around and be really uncomfortable with. So it's not specific to us. We think that all these people, you know, have anxiety anyway. They would have OCD. It just manifests itself in this way because this is something that's important to them. So OCD usually picks on something that's really important to the sufferer. We see a lot of parents that are concerned that maybe they're going to harm their child, or a lot of teachers that are afraid that they're going to turn into pedophiles. So it's common for it to be something that's important. And for us, our frumkeit is important.
Right.
So it makes sense that for frum Jews, this is a really common thing that in terms of the way that their OCD can manifest itself.
So the person is, if they weren't religious, they would have an anxiety. The religion isn't giving them the anxiety disorder.
Correct.
The anxiety disorder is attaching to their religion because their religion is important. And if they weren't religious,
it would be something else.
Some other area in their life that was important, whether it was being a parent or whatever else their job might be.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, oh my gosh, I'm a doctor. I'm, you know, obsessing about maybe killing somebody.
By accident.
Okay. So, right. So that's very helpful to understand, and I think probably very calming for people who worry that, you know, the religion is doing it to people. No, people have anxiety disorders, and then it attaches to the important things in their life. So I would imagine that because it's sort of not what we would call ego dystonic, meaning people don't feel badly about it or don't think it's a problem necessarily, because I'm very, you know, very pious or very busy with certain things, does that mean they don't come for help as often or as commonly as somebody else with OCD might come for help eventually?
So yeah, I mean, that does seem to be true. So because of exactly what you said, they tend to feel like, well, maybe this isn't a problem, or, you know, the only person that's really impacted here is me, right? So like, what does my wife care if I wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning to start going to the bathroom? What a leeway in terms of letting them spend some extra time davening or whatever it is. They don't have that same idea that, you know, this is really interfering with my life. And when they think about the fact that it's painful for them, because many of them can recognize that it's painful, but people will say, but who says that being frum is supposed to be easy?
Right.
And so it's really okay that, you know, it's painful for me. Yeah, mm-hmm. Maybe it has to be painful mm-hmm. in order to really get through these mitzvos.
Right.
And so, I mean, I'm not saying that that's what the Torah says necessarily,
right.
But that's some of the sentiment, is that it's okay.
And probably I'm imagining that sentiment is being given if there isn't enough exploration.
Yeah.
Which we're going to get to in a minute, because I think it's really important to help the Rebbetzins and college teachers figure out how to do the exploration that will get them, because the point that I want to kind of pick on before that is that, or to ask, I guess, I'm imagining that the Rebbetzin and the college teacher, which is why I said at the beginning of this that I'm really excited for this piece to be part of the series, I'm imagining that the Rebbetzin or the college teacher, maybe the Rav, is sort of the person who's going to help pick up on this.
Yeah.
Because the person, it's so, you know, egocentric, this is fine, this is good, I've gotten praise for my frumkeit. It's the person that they're going to come to with their question. And, you know, obviously a formal shaila goes to a rav, but the woman will go to her kala teacher with some follow-up questions about the halachas that the kala teacher, you know, taught her, or maybe she'll go talk to the Rebbetzin because it's more comfortable, you know, to talk to the Rebbetzin, who then maybe will, you know, turn to the rav to ask the particular shaila. But that Rebbe Tzinner Kala teacher might be getting a lot of the question, a lot of the angst. She's going to be the person who could say, you know, I think you might want to talk to somebody. Because the person themselves, it sounds like, is not very often going to wind up saying, I think I need to talk to a therapist about this religiousness, because they're seeing it as religiousness.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that certainly, you know, the religious leaders in our community wind up oftentimes being the front line for all of this, because they're looking at this as an issue related to halacha or related to their frumkeit. And, you know, so they're going to seek out the guidance from those people in their lives, I think, prior to seeing a therapist. So the good news is that most therapists who work with scrupulosity are very receptive to working with the religious leaders of the community as well, because it's oftentimes such an important part of treatment for the patient to know that that's happening and to know that it's that the treatment itself is being supported by the religious leaders. So that's really great. I mean, a lot of times when I have worked, especially with Rabbanim, that they really are so grateful that the person is in treatment, because they have heard the same shilas like over and over again, and you know, and they sort of don't know what to do anymore. So oftentimes it's really great to have that collaboration. I was just going to say that that's really one of the first things that religious leaders should be looking for, is the repetitive nature of the questions or comments or thoughts. It's almost like you're hearing the person obsessed, right? It's almost like you're hearing the thought process that they're going through in their mind. So when they start talking about kashas and they are saying, you know, it's so hard for me because my flea shake hands, and, you know, I'm worried now about how I'm going to make the kids supper today because, you know, I just don't feel like I can get this, I can get my hands clean enough, or, you know, I'm constantly having problems in my kitchen and I see that I'm spending so much time there. Kind of when you're hearing this thought process that seems really different than the way that you hopefully experience it yourself,
right?
Pay attention to that and to start asking questions like, are there other areas that are also difficult for you? So especially for a woman, you know, if she starts talking about kashrus, I would absolutely want to start talking about Taras HaMishpacha, because it's so common, you know?
Right.
Post where we as women are really responsible for things on our own tend to be the most challenging, because it's that sense of responsibility that, you know, I don't have somebody checking up on me, you know, when I'm in my own kitchen.
Right.
I worry about that, right? That's what the way, you know, that's sort of how the thought process goes. So absolutely, if you're hearing repetitive questions or repetitive content area that, you know, seems really intense in the way that the person speaks about it, or very, very detailed in the way that they're asking, you know, not even shilas, but just kind of talking about it in a way that just seems like too much detail and things that don't really line up or make sense, it's absolutely worth asking.
So it's the, you know, just to sort of break it down for how they're going to start to solicit and understand that what is going on is maybe scrupulosity as opposed to religious commitment.
Yeah.
You know, missing the forest for the trees, being so busy with a particular aspect that you miss the rest of, you know, what's supposed to be going on. It's the kind of pained or, you know, elongated process, the maybe this and the maybe that, and the thought process that's sort of like, where is this coming from, and who and where worries about this level of things. I imagine that it's also the repetitive nature of the questions. I'm getting either the same question every month or a similar question every month. So last month it was, I'm not sure if I brushed my teeth fully and completely. And this time it's, I'm not sure if I got all the tangles out of my hair.
Exactly.
So it might be technically a different question, but it's sort of, you're never sure and you're always sort of obsessing. And is there a quality or lack of quality, especially when it's the same question, of not being able to calm down. You know, I think especially for a Rav and maybe even for a Kala teacher who's used to teaching, you know, the halachas, and maybe having somebody come back about the halacha, that I'm imagining there's a different quality to somebody who just sort of wants to double check something, the Rav or the Rebbetzin or the Kala teacher reassures them or reminds them and they move on. And there's a different quality to the person who is, you know, suffering with OCD. It's not this quick, no, I said that, and then they say, okay, and then you move on. It's, they argue with you maybe a little bit, or they struggle with you, let's say, about, but what about this? But what about that? But what, wait a minute. And, you know, it's a different feel to the process.
Exactly. It's the person that is taking really copious notes, right? I mean, I know a lot of Kalas that will take notes, you know, nothing wrong with that, but we're talking about like really copious notes, double and triple checking about what a Kala teacher might have said. Or like you said, you know, they might come to the Rebbetzin and say, well, the Rav answered the Shaila this way, but, you know, I'm still concerned because what if the Rav didn't understand that when I said my hair was still tangled, you know, maybe he couldn't picture it, or maybe he didn't understand that I only brushed it for 15, you know, combed it for 15 minutes instead of my usual 40. Like maybe the Rav didn't, you know, misunderstood. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's sort of just like you said, kind of that double checking, not trusting the answer, not feeling confident when it's done. And it's kind of that repetitive nature. It's the fact that it's happening regularly, even if the content is a little bit different, but it's still, you know, how often and how frequently are people asking these things or talking about these things?
Right. And I guess, I don't know, but would that be similar if she's husband is busy with these things or busy with her about these things? You know, how does it sound different when a husband says, you know, are you sure you whatever, and when it's OCD or scrupulosity, there should be a baseline of trust.
Yeah, I mean, that is really, I think that that's really, really challenging because, you know, I guess that there could be a couple of different things that could be going on. So one is the concern that I have that if it's not anxiety based, then is it more of a controlling situation and more of a domineering situation where, you know, the wife is being constantly badgered. Did you do X, Y, and Z correctly? How do I know? Or somebody like sort of, you know, maybe physically standing over her shoulder to make sure that things are happening, or wanting, you know, a husband maybe wanting to talk to a mikvah attendant, or, you know, talk to a rav who passed the shaila for her, or, I mean, those kinds of things that if it's a situation like that, where it's really about control and it's not anxiety based, that's sort of a, unfortunately, a separate issue. If it is anxiety based, In terms of the impact that it could have, I think the effects are probably, you know, equally as devastating, except that the woman might be able to say, I can see my husband is just like terrified and really anxious and fearful about this. So maybe I as the wife, am trying to do my best to reassure him or to help other people in the community to reassure him. But unfortunately, with OCD and with anxiety, we know that all the reassurance in the world doesn't actually work, which I'm sure is something that we'll talk about in more detail.
Right, right. And you know, certainly from my perspective, working with, you know, women who are in being abused or controlled and abused, and sort of in my mind, when a woman can say to her spouse, I'm not doing this.
Right.
No, we're not doing this. You know, you can clean for Pesach or I can clean for Pesach, but you're not cleaning for Pesach with me or watching me. It's not, no. And when that can diffuse it,
yep,
then we're talking about anxiety because there isn't reassurance, there isn't answering to. Now, if that causes an escalation,
yeah,
what do you mean we're not doing this? Because you can't say no to the abuser. When it causes an escalation, you're probably talking about control. When it causes a diffusion, not going there with you, then it we're probably talking about anxiety, because like you said, the reassurance actually feeds the anxiety, and the I'm not going there kind of diffuses the situation, not their situation, whatever they're going to be worried about.
Exactly.
But what you're going to worry about on my account, shutting it down shuts it down as opposed to escalates it.
Yeah, I would say that's a good rule of thumb.
And so if they're hearing sort of this overbearingness, the question to sort of explore with the woman is, what happens if you say, yeah, I'm not going over that again?
Yeah.
My wife said not to go over that again, and I'm not going over that again. What will happen? If it diffuses things, then that's one picture. And if that you talk to the Rav and it escalates things, it, you know, we might be talking about a different kind of situation. Yeah. But the woman herself could be empowered to sort of say, you only have to answer that once, or that's your domain. You do not have to, you know, go over every bidika with him. That is your domain, and you just tell him in my name, it shuts things down. Then we're probably talking about his scrupulosity.
Yeah, there's really actually a very nice shuva from the stipler about that, where the stipler just says, like, no, if you have a man that's asking all these questions and it's anxiety based, you know, about his woman's yashas for taras mishpacha, like, shut it down. You know, that is not his area. He should not worry about it. He should not deal with it at all. It should be totally out of his domain.
Right.
And yeah, you're right, that works very differently for anxiety versus
And right. So the woman, you know, should understand that if it's gonna work, she needs to have the backing of the Rav that it's okay to do that.
Right.
And that she should be encouraged to use that backing and not feel bad or mean or wrong for shutting it down. She's actually being helpful, because that's the only thing that's going to shut the anxiety around this down, not the reassurance. And I imagine that's the same advice that you find yourself giving to the Rabbanim, because in my mind, it could be really hard to say to somebody who looks and sounds like they're going to feel so much better if you reassure them, to tell them, stop reassuring them. Because it looks like I should reassure them. That would be, they need it, and I should do that. And you're probably in the position of telling the Rav, like, or the Rebbetzin or the stop, don't. How does that usually work for, you know, when you're working with somebody?
So, I mean, I think you're right. I think that that's like one of the hardest things. I think that everybody in all of these different professions, right, we do what we do because we're looking to help someone. And so when we think about helping someone, it's whatever we think is going to be the best to help take away some of their suffering. In these particular situations, it always seems like reassurance is going to be useful. But I think that it's actually a pretty quick lesson to learn. For all of the professionals that are seeing this, you know, that it's not going to work, because very quickly they're going to be back at your doorstep with a very similar type of issue, and they're going to be in just as much pain as they had before. It may be even the same issue. So you thought you sort of fixed it. But of course that didn't happen for them. So it's very easy to see that what we're doing sometimes isn't working. The harder part is to stop ourselves from doing it when the person almost seems, or sometimes literally, is kind of begging for this reassurance. So once the person is engaged in treatment, it's much easier for, because you know that you basically have kind of the patient's permission to say, no, I'm sorry, it doesn't make sense for me to provide you with reassurance right now. And they know that, and it's still hard and still painful, but they're on board with it. It's like they've said, you know, it's okay for you to say no. Mm-hmm. However, if a patient is not engaged in treatment or is still in the phase where they're saying there's not a problem here, I don't know what you're talking about, all I need the Rav to do is to answer this Shiloh for me, that's a lot more complicated.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. The Rebbetzin, the Kala teacher, the Rav, has sort of figured out that all of these Shilohs are not necessarily not legitimate in a broad sense,
mm-hmm, but, they could be, sure.
Right, but and maybe some of them are actually very legitimate, but that there's a general problem of scrupulosity.
Yeah.
And that this person, with their continued shilas, some of which are repetitive and OCD in nature, that this person really needs help.
Yeah.
How do you recommend a clergy person, to use a broader, you know, whoever we're talking about, how do you recommend that they broach this with the person? Do you have some recommendations, some language, some approach that you know, kind of would be best practice? And how do you say to somebody who's calling you for the 10th month or 110th month in a row with a new, you know, concern about whether they really should have gone in or didn't dunk enough farther and the mikveh attendant didn't realize? How do you break it to them that you're, you know, it's time to get some help?
Well, and I mean, it's such a great question. I think that, and I think, by the way, that, you know, including and hopefully empowering the Rebbetzins and the college teachers that are seeing this to also think about including the mikvah attendants as part of this conversation, because they're also right there on the front lines and oftentimes seeing these things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that because the way that we're sensing that there's a problem is because of our own intuition and our own experience, I'm gonna say clinical experience, because that's really sort of what this is for all of us, mm-hmm. you know, that's what we fall back on to say, listen, I have some concerns about what you're going through right now, because in my experience, I'm seeing that there's something different about the way that you're going about this issue, about this mitzvah, about this situation, right? So, you know, I, as a challah teacher, I have worked with, you know, hundreds of challahs, and I'm really noticing that there's something different about the way that you're coming back to me and asking these questions, or the fear that you have when you express this, the pain that you're going through when you talk about these things. I'm really feeling like there's something that's different about it. And so this is my concern for you. I think that in our role, it's really nice to be able to say that this is not uncommon, and that because it's not uncommon, we have really good treatment for it. So there are things that can really help you. And as somebody that you've already confided in and somebody that you have been willing to talk about this with, I want you to know that, you know, I want to support you in being able to go through treatment and to do something differently. Because when we talk about mitzvos, it's just not supposed to be painful like this.
Mm.
And if you're able to go through treatment, I think that you'll find that everything that you're trying to do with all of these rituals will actually wind up being, you know, so much easier for you. Your connection to Hashem will be able to be strengthened
You
know, once you're not dealing with this OCD on your back.
Right. Wow. That sounds great. Can still be hard, maybe. Absolutely. In certain personal situations, you know, because there's often multiple levels and multiple layers, I should say, of relationship.
Yeah.
Between a Rebbetzin or a challah teacher and the person who's coming to them, and a Rav and the person who's coming to them, and who they are in their community or in their life.
Absolutely.
But I think that, you know, you can't have better language than that. It's really caring, and it's really connected, and it's really focused on the right things, not dismissing and not alluding, but really kind of hits the mark. So thank you. That was great. What are there particular resistances that you think people have to doing this that we should be aware of, and that we could also maybe include in how we address the person? Typical resistances to getting help that we might include, you know, might be mindful of.
I would say that the two that come to mind for me first are concerns about whether the person that's going to treat them will really understand, particularly if they think that the person is either, even if they know that the person is either not Jewish or not from, is oftentimes a big concern. Certainly, you know, depending on where you live, there may or may not be people who are well trained in the treatment of OCD and scrupulosity. We know that just like OCD providers tend to live on the East Coast, a little bit of the West Coast and Chicago. And that's about all we've got.
Oh no.
Yeah. So there's really, I mean, it's sort of just, it's sort of a very specific training that people go through. And so, you know, we might be talking about somebody who doesn't live where there's, and especially if you're looking for a firm provider, the number goes down significantly.
Right. So
people may worry about seeing somebody that is not from, because there's, because these issues are so closely tied to halakha. Mm-hmm. I think the other issue that people sometimes have is, even if they are working with a firm provider, once they learn the rationale for treatment, which is sort of essentially, we're going to do most of the things that you're afraid of, and we're not going to do any rituals that you would typically do to make yourself feel better. Once they know that, I think they worry that even a firm provider would somehow want them to, you know, be over on something, would want them to, you know, push the line too far. Right. In their mind, if I say I want you to touch your milk container and then I want you to touch your deli, they're now concerned that I just said I want you to eat a bacon cheeseburger. Right. That's sort of almost how they're hearing it. And so they worry that, you know, those lines are going to be blurred and that treatment is going to mean that they're kind of giving up on the halacha, that they're pushing something where they shouldn't. Right. And I think that, you know, the clergy in our community are in a perfect position to be able to kind of reassure them, which in this case, I think the reassurance is, you know, good, right? That, like, that's not where any of this is headed at all.
Right.
It's, you know, certainly in terms of the treatment itself, that's part of why we work with Rabbanim, to make sure that we are doing, you know, what is halakhically permissible, and that we are pushing it to where it feels uncomfortable for the person, but of course is not actually going against halakha.
Right. So that's like a primary, that when somebody, you know, sort of says to somebody in the way that you said it, you know, I think you want to get some help, that following that up with, and I will make sure, or I'll, you know, I have no problem being in touch with and in contact with your provider.
Exactly.
To make sure that they're not out of bounds in any way. Yeah. But that's going to help you a lot more than me constantly being in touch with you over Shiloh's and the way that you want me to be in touch with you over questions or, you know, details over what we learned in Kala class, because you just keep having the same
exactly
things over and over. And somebody like this, I can help or be a partner with helping you kind of get to a different place in your Avodas Hashem.
Exactly. And so I will say, you know, in terms of the potential necessity of working with a provider who is not Jewish or not from, I mean, people who treat scrupulosity specifically will, I mean, almost always work with clergy when it's appropriate, whether, I mean, I've worked with clergy outside of our religion for various patients at times, because I only know what I know about us. I don't really know nearly as much about other religions. And so, I mean, I think that people, you know, providers are, who do this work are pretty careful to make sure that they're not stepping outside the bounds. And frankly, when we talk about OCD, right, somebody who is treating OCD because the person is afraid that maybe they are going to get HIV from, you know, they're typically afraid that they're going to get HIV from touching a doorknob or from shaking someone's hands, you know, and so as the OCD treatment provider, of course we're going to be doing things like touching doorknobs and shaking hands. Mm-hmm. However, the OCD treatment provider is never going to take a known contaminated needle, make sure it's well inserted into the person's vein, and do it repetitively to make sure that we got it good.
Right. So
it's the same thing when a provider is treating scrupulosity. The name of the game is to be able to have them push those boundaries. Sure, I can touch milchig and touch fleishig. I can cook, you know, something fleishig and cook something milchig simultaneously. But I'm not going to take milk and pour it into my chicken soup and say, it doesn't matter.
Right. But I would imagine that for certain people, even if they're seeing a firm provider, if the firm provider isn't from their part of the firm community,
absolutely,
that initial sort of, you know, haskama or connection with their rav or the rav that they can pretty much trust, you know, in a general way, because there's probably a lot of, but you didn't understand that isn't about trust, it's about their OCD. Having that person have a connection with the from provider would still kind of need to happen for them to be able to go into treatment and say, okay, I can go into treatment and I'm not going to be really asked to push the boundaries to a place that, you know, is going to bring me to be high of chorus or, you know, whatever the fear is.
Well, I mean, and as a female provider, I mean, certainly I have worked with a lot of men who are uncomfortable just because, you know, because they typically would not be seeing a female for issues like this, except that, you know, I do what I do. And so knowing that they have that hasgama from their Rabbanim or from the Rosh Yeshiva has mattered a lot, I think, just in even getting them through the door.
Right. And I imagine that, you know, we want to put a plug in for, you know, making sure that whoever is the contact person with the mental health provider is also open to what the mental health provider has to tell them about what is not helpful for the treatment and what is helpful for the treatment. Like, please, 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 please don't pick up the phone to this person in between such. I'm just making it up. I don't know. But that there could be some really hard things we're asking somebody to do or not do. And that we really have to kind of push them. I remember a situation years and years ago, and I'm not an anxiety person. I don't treat anxiety, but people do have anxieties that come in for other things. And realizing that this woman, if I answered her call once to remind her, please, I forgot when my appointment is.
Right.
And I'd have four calls in the week.
Right.
And eventually just saying to her, I will not answer any of your calls. Just know that, because that's part of what's going on, you know, with your treatment and your anxiety. Just know I'm not going to answer your calls. But the first week when I really did not return her calls was distressing.
Of course, you felt terrible.
Right. So being open to what you're going to have to do might feel bad,
but
be right, you know, I think is a really important point to make to the Rebbetzin or college teacher or Rav that might be involved in the treatment or in the connection with the mental health professional around this person's treatment. It's not going to feel good to sort of, you know, get the call and say, you know, I'm not going to answer you.
Yep.
But the close connection with the professional you've spoken things through and trust, obviously, I hope will help that.
And so I think that, I mean, the way that I think about it is the same way when I talk to a person's spouse, you know, and talk about what treatment is going to look like. Because, of course, oftentimes the spouse is the one who is also asked for a ton of reassurance or a lot of these things. And to say that you want to always be able to offer support. You want to be able to offer encouragement. Like, I know you can do this. You know, you're going to do great. I know this is really tough, but I'm so proud of you. And at the same time, be able to hold firm and say, but I'm not going to provide you with that reassurance. I'm not even going to listen to what you have to say about what you think you just messed up in the kitchen. I just want you to know that I'm so proud of you for all this hard work.
Right. So those are great, you know, a great compromise when you don't want to feel mean. That's a great compromise, sounds like, for spouse or for, you know, Rebbetzin, Kala teacher Rav. I know you're struggling with this, and I know you made the call kind of knowing I'm not going to answer you, and I really applaud that, you know, how hard you're working, and I'm going to work really hard too, because it's really hard for me also. You know, I think that that's probably an honesty is okay. It's really hard for me not to, but yeah. I'm not going to, because I know you don't really, you know, it won't really be good for you, or, you know, we're in this together. I'm not going to, you're not going to, I don't know, something along those
lines. Yeah, exactly.
Right. So this has been really helpful and important. Like I said, this is one of the ones that I think is really crucial for Rebbetzins and college teachers, because they are probably a primary gatekeeper to treatment for this issue, more than many, most, whatever word you want to use, other areas, that they are the gatekeeper around issues of scrupulosity. Is there anything else we should be aware of that you want to say for them in their role, for them to know? Or is there anything you would recommend that people who want to know more about this read that would be kind of easy reading, or just another fact? Any last
Yeah, there are a couple of really great books that I think are very helpful for both folks who are suffering with OCD, but also for other people just to get a better understanding of it. So one of them is a book by Dr. Jonathan Grayson. It's G-R-A-Y-S-O-N, and it's called Freedom from OCD. And so it's just a really, really, I think it's a very easy read and a really great way to understand it. The second book is specific to issues within the religious community, and that is a book by Rabbi Dr. Viktor Bonchek, and it is called, hold on one sec, Religious Compulsions and Fears, A Guide to Treatment. And so that would also be another really good resource. Mm-hmm. And so that might be another way to go about it, would be to say, like, hey, take a look at this book, you know, and then let's talk about it afterwards. See if this doesn't sound familiar to you, mm-hmm. in terms of kind of what you're going through on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Well, that's a really great way of normalizing it. You know, it's sort of, because you were saying before, this is common and you know, I want you to know that people struggle with this and I want to help you with it. It's sort of even more to the point that it's common if there's a whole book out there written about it and they didn't write it just for one person. So it's not something to have shame about or have, you know, embarrassment or stigma about. This is something that happens that can be helped.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the last thing that I would just say to the folks who are watching this is just to think about the fact that if something doesn't feel right to you, you know, to think about that as your clinical judgment and to say, well, it's at least worth the person getting it checked out. I could really be doing them a favor if I help them to at least get an evaluation for this. Because we would do the same thing if we had that concern medically. If somebody was saying to us, well, you know, I have had this cough for a while, or, you know, I have had this thing going on, we would feel more comfortable and confident to say, you know, why don't you at least see a doctor?
Right. And that can happen at every level. You know, they can check it with themselves. If I'm a COLA teacher for 20 years and here's a nervous COLA, I could say to myself, okay, a lot of COLAs are nervous, but if something in my gut is saying, this is not the same nervous as most COLAs, you know, I have what to check that against. Let me check that against what my other COLAs have felt like in their nervousness. And this is feeling different. Well, that's different. And if I'm a new COLA teacher, I have colleagues who are COLA teachers for 20 years. Yes. And if I'm worried about this COLA's nervousness, I can ask my colleagues, hey, you know, I don't think this level of nervousness is just typical COLA nervousness, but maybe I'm wrong. Can I describe it to you?
Exactly.
Get some checkout before you, you know, you might want to, if you're feeling nervous about saying something to somebody, so check it out with a colleague first. And if you get that reassurance from the colleague that, yeah, your gut is right, then you can say, how about you check it out? Maybe you want to talk to somebody about this because I'm a little